It's the Da Vinci Code, of course, because he says that Da Vinci, Leonardo, is what art historians would call him, but Dan Brown always refers to him as Da Vinci. Leonardo encoded all of this stuff into his paintings, The Last Supper in particular. There's the clever little animation in the film, which is shifts those people out of the way, and we put Mary Magdalene over there. Oh my word, they fit together! Ah! The way Dan Brown interprets Leonardo's painting is really quite extraordinary, but it does mean that they can set up images like this within the film, where the Holy Grail, the bloodline, the royal bloodline of Mary Magdalene, there she is in Leonardo's painting, and with Sophie Nevers, the last living descendant, we discover at the end of the film, at the end of the book, in the same frame. There's the bloodline going on down through history. Dan Brown makes a big deal of the fact that Leonardo omitted the chalice from this painting. There's just these little cups. Did he omit the chalice? Well, no. Chalices weren't used by first century peasants. Chalices are the drinking vessels of the rich and powerful, of the elite, not of peasants who've been living rough for the best part of 3 years as Jesus travelled round first century Palestine. They wouldn't have had a chalice at their Last Supper. Besides which, in the original Grail legends, the Holy Grail was a bowl, not a chalice anyway. It was the bowl that Joseph of Arimathea used to catch the blood of Jesus on the cross. That's not Dan Brown's fault, that changed a long time ago. There's also no reason at all why there would only have been one cup at the Last Supper. Yes, Jesus says, this is the cup of the New Covenant. That's a metaphor. He's actually talking about the wine within the cup representing the blood that he was about to shed on the cross. Why would 13 men go and have this last meal together with just a single cup? Would add a whole new meaning. So can you pass the wine, please? Just this one cup going round and round and round. It's not a very practical way of eating. But then Leonardo's not setting out to present a historical picture anyway. They wouldn't have been sitting at a big table on upright chairs. They'd have been lounging on the floor. Here's a bit of a close-up of the bit in question. Because Dan Brown says, look at this figure. Look at John the Evangelist leaning away from Jesus. Doesn't he look a little bit effeminate? It's all very well being fresh-shaven, but that's a woman. They're joined at the hip. And Jesus is wearing red and blue, and John stroke Mary is wearing blue and red. This really is the Holy Grail. This is the bloodline. And Leonardo has put it in the painting. Is John really Mary Magdalene? No. I haven't yet come across a single art historian who has any respect in the art world who was prepared to argue this. They all laugh and say it's nonsense. Leonardo would not have excluded John, even if he'd wanted to include Mary. He was painting for a religious group who were known as heresy hunters at the time. They were sticklers for getting things right. There is no way he'd have left John out. In the conventions of the time, Mary was put into many paintings of Jesus, not Last Supper paintings. She was always painted at Jesus' feet. I was at a lecture last week with Susan Haskins up at Winchester Cathedral. Susan Haskins is probably the world's greatest authority on Mary Magdalene and her representation down through history. And she showed many, many pictures that have been painted down through history. And again, Mary was being shown at Jesus' feet. Besides which, Leonardo liked painting androgynous young men. This isn't the only painting in which somebody like this appears. And then John has traditionally been seen as young and clean-shaven. We know that John was still alive towards the end of the first century AD, 60 years perhaps after Jesus' death, which means that when he was following Jesus around as part of the group of disciples, he must have been a very young man, possibly even a late teenager. And so in medieval paintings and Renaissance paintings, again and again, John was shown in this kind of way. Here's one example, not terribly effeminate looking, but he's young and clean shaven. Or how about this one, just from a little bit later, similar again, a little bit more effeminate looking. And here, Jacopo da Ponte's painting, where John is very young and arguably more feminine looking than in Leonardo's painting. That was the convention. That was how John was always painted. But Dan Brown ignores all that because he wants to focus in on something else. Really, this business about Mary Magdalene and the Holy Grail is a little bit of a red herring in itself. But before we leave her, here's a quote from James Robinson, the editor of the Nag Hammadi Library. Robinson is not a Christian, He was brought up a Christian, but he wouldn't describe himself in those terms now. But he says that I think the only relevant text for historical information about Mary Magdalene is the New Testament. And it does not go beyond saying that she was one of the circle of women who accompanied the wandering Jesus and his male followers. There is no evidence that Mary was ever married to Jesus, whether from Leonardo or from the Gnostic Gospels or from anywhere else. It's complete speculation. We may pick that up a little bit more in questions. But this is what Dan Brown really wants to talk about. Goddess spirituality. I've said already that it's the spiritual nature of this book, the spiritual search within the book, that has really ignited people in many ways. And goddess spirituality is big in our culture these days. Here's a quote from the book. "The Grail is symbolic of the lost goddess. When Christianity came along, the old pagan religions didn't die easily. Legends of chivalric quests for the lost grail were in fact stories of forbidden quests to find the lost sacred feminine. Knights who claimed to be searching for the chalice were speaking in code as a way to protect themselves from a church that had subjugated women, banished the goddess, burned non-believers, and forbidden the pagan reverence for the sacred feminine." This quest for the sacred feminine, which Robert Langdon seems to be a part of, is very significant. It's partly because feminism within our culture has radically altered women's expectations, and rightly so in very many ways. Women do not want any longer to be defined in relation to the men in their lives. They expect some degree of autonomy and of individual worth and of personal fulfillment, rightly so. But because of that shift within our culture, there are women around, many, sadly, who still feel that the traditional church is not for them, particularly the Roman Catholic Church, it has to be said, which is bears the brunt of Dan Brown's criticism on the whole. Here's Dan Brown in an address he gave to the New Hampshire Writers Project a couple of years ago. He said, 2,000 years ago, we lived in a world of gods and goddesses. Today, we live in a world solely of gods. Women in most cultures have been stripped of their spiritual power. The novel touches on questions of how and why the shift has occurred and on what lessons we might learn from it regarding our future. Now, that's not in the novel. That's him addressing a group of writers, and he's saying this is a big issue within our society. Here is Margaret Starbird, one of the authors that is a big influence on Dan Brown. In fact, in the discussion in Lee Teabing's study in the book, two of her books are explicitly mentioned, The Woman with the Alabaster Jar and The Goddess in the Gospels. Margaret Starbird says in an interview, "For two millennia, Christians have been attributing exclusively masculine images to God, using masculine pronouns when speaking of the Creator. The sacred feminine is that other face of God that has not been honored over the two millennia of Christianity, at least not as a fully equal partner." And she goes on, "I believe we need to reclaim the lost feminine at all levels, physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual." As I say, this is one of the big influences on Dan Brown. This is where the whole quest for the sacred feminine within the book has come from. She finishes off, "We have suffered the loss of eros, relationship, and deep connection with the feminine, the body, the emotions, the intuitive, the kinship of all the living, the blessings of the beautiful and bountiful planet." It's very moving stuff, but we'll see what it means in a minute.